Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Jerry Brown is no longer governor of California, so it's time to look at his legacy, and there's some oil stains on his legacy. Derek Seidman is an investigative reporter at the Public Accountability Initiative. He joins us today, and he reports on the story that no California reporter dug into during the 8 years while Jerry Brown's been governor most recently. And it's the story of how his former personal secretary, Lucy Gikovich, became a powerful lobbyist for oil and gas. And it appears she had deep influence on Governor Brown, leading to vetoes of critical legislation and concessions to the polluters in his vaunted cap-and-trade extension. Yes, Jerry Brown has been taking care of business. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who support my work, including Billy Cook, Terry Paris, Cheryl Fleming, and Terry Paris is there again. How many subscriptions do you have, Teresa? Well, why don't you take the load off Teresa Paris? I'd like to see you, yes, you with the earbuds there, become a subscriber to the PBC podcast. All you got to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber. You land on the sign-up page and it's easy. Heck, Terry Paris has done it multiple times. She's a repeat offender. I thank you for listening, and I thank all of you who support my work. Edmund G. Brown II, Jerry Brown, has retired as governor of California. And now it's time to look at his legacy. And I find it complicated.
Have you ever watched a moonbeam as it slid across your window pane?
Harry Nilsson opens the podcast today.
Or struggled with a bit of rain, or dance about the weather vane, or settle on a moving train and wonder where the train's been.
That would be a reference to the high-speed rail that Jerry Brown hoped to build on his second tour as governor here in the Golden State. And I want to open by acknowledging the complexities of Jerry Brown's legacy. And I'm somewhat conflicted. Just last week, I published an op-ed in the San Jose Mercury News defending Governor Brown from the state Supreme Court as they intervened to block a series of clemency grants that he wrote as he was preparing to leave the governor's office. And I believe the state Supreme Court abused its discretion in imposing those restrictions on the governor. I've also praised Jerry Brown for his reforms to the criminal justice system. He essentially corrected some of the errors that he made while he was a young governor in the 1970s and early 80s. And there are many other issues where I have agreed or disagreed with Jerry Brown. But when it comes to his claim of being the climate change crusader, the guy who went to the Vatican when the Trump administration wouldn't send a representative, the guy who has posed as this staunch defender of the environment, and yet his record comes up extremely short when you compare it to the rhetoric and to the public face that he enjoys about these issues. So just before the Christmas holidays, a new report caught my attention. It came from an investigative unit that's based way outside California in Buffalo, New York. And that organization is called the Public Accountability Project. One of its lead authors is Derek Seidman, and he joins me today from snowy Buffalo. Derek, thanks for being with me.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
And thank you for the work you did on this report. I only have one complaint, that it would have been helpful to see this a year or two ago when we could actually have exposed the governor's connections to a powerful lobbyist who had extreme influence over him. But I respect that you took the time that it takes to do a detailed investigation, and your report is rich in detail. Everything is footnoted. And I want to ask you to begin by explaining to my national listeners, what is the Public Accountability Initiative, and who funds it? Obviously, it's not oil and gas interests.
Yeah, so we are a nonprofit watchdog research group based in Buffalo. We focus on corporate and government accountability. So we do a lot of research around Wall Street, around the oil and gas industry, and other sort of main sectors that have a lot of influence over our society and over politics. We're sort of a follow the money research organization. We've been around a little over 10 years. And we're funded by a host of foundations and organizations, as well as individual funders. It's all listed on our website if anybody wants to go. So we don't hide anything.
Yeah, and let me just enumerate. The American Federation of Teachers is a funder. The ARCA Foundation, Ford Foundation, Open Society Foundations. That's George Soros, and some people find that problematic. The Park Foundation has supported independent media and media reform for a long time. So, you know, I don't think that you have conflicts related to your funding, particularly in view of this report about Governor Brown and California. So what first triggered your interest? Because I'll note, Derek, that this is an important story that was never reported by California-based media, independent, corporate, or any other stripe.
Believe me, I was taken aback when we did the research and started putting the story together, and I realized that this hadn't been talked about before. And I agree with what you said at the beginning of the interview, that this would have been nice to have found a little earlier. But the story of how we figured it out is, you know, I was in the Bay Area at the time of the climate summit, and I was talking to people there, and I heard about a struggle that was going on with local activists around Phillips 66's San Francisco refinery, and how Phillips 66 was trying to more than double the importing of tar sands crude oil from Canada into its refinery. So it just got me, you know, kind of curious. And when I got back to Buffalo, I started doing a little bit of research around Phillips 66 in California, and I started looking at their lobbyists. And I saw that the Crane Group, and in particular, this lobbyist Lucy Gikovich, was they were, you know, at the top of the list. I mean, they were, you know, pretty far and away the highest paid lobbying firm, and she was the highest paid lobbyist by Phillips 66, one of the major oil, you know, powerhouses in the world as well as in the state. Mm-hmm. So I just started, you know, looking into her a little bit, and, you know, and just followed the research, and the story became clearer and clearer that she wasn't just someone who was, you know, knew Jerry Brown, that she had a history with him that went back half a century, and that the two of them are incredibly close friends, and they also have a pretty long working history together as well. And
you detail in the investigative report that they're so close that when Jerry Brown went to Washington, D.C. on California business, he would stay at the home of Lucy Gikovich. And this raises important legal issues about, consorting with a lobbyist. And the California rules are pretty stringent about accepting gifts from a lobbyist. And an overnight at a home in Washington, D.C. is the equivalent of a couple of $100 saved on a hotel room. And that is an inappropriate in-kind contribution that likely was not reported. I don't believe it was. And so just that little tidbit right there is I think, fascinating. And you show that California media often reported that Brown didn't stay in a hotel when he went to Washington, but they never connected the dots that he was accepting the hospitality of a lobbyist who, as you point out, collected almost $1 million from Phillip 66 alone.
Yeah, that's correct. And the report also calls for an investigation into possible ethics violations for the reasons that you just mentioned.
Now, let's take a look, because you do spend some time explaining who Lucy Gikovich is. And she goes back to the first two terms of Jerry Brown as governor of California. That was in the from the mid-1970s to the early 80s. And she was his personal executive secretary. And, there is no hint of any inappropriate or romantic or sexual contact. Jerry Brown's always been kind of a monk. He married very late in life. So I'm not suggesting anything inappropriate there. But Gikovich and Brown have been very tight. Then when he became mayor of Oakland, it was in the late 1990s, she was working at Platinum Advisors. Now, you're based in Buffalo, so let me take a moment here, Derek, to explain to our listeners that Platinum Advisors showed up in the report that we broadcast. It was a video interview. We shared it with Consortium News, and so it was available on a national basis. And this is all on the work of my colleague Peter Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, the investigative journalist who showed that Darius Anderson, the owner of Platinum Advisors, partnered with the son of retired Senator Barbara Boxer, Doug Boxer. And they formed a company that fleeced the Grayton Indian tribe. Now, Senator Boxer had authored the legislation that took a dissolved Indian tribe, the Graytons, and allowed them to reconstitute and claim territory anywhere in a couple of counties here in Northern California. And when they claimed that property, it gave them the right to build a casino. And so Doug Boxer and Darius Anderson had a scam and a scheme where they attempted to collect over $40 million in fees and commissions for trying to facilitate the building of a casino on a piece of property where it never panned out. And so it's quite a story. And it all revolves around the work of Darius Anderson and Doug Boxer and Anderson's firm, Platinum Advisors. So Gikovich worked for them, you say, in D.C. through the 2000s, and her last filing with Platinum was in 2009. That is the time when Jerry Brown shifted, and he was the attorney general here in California. So that's a fascinating piece of background. And then Gikovich joined a company called the Crane Group. What can you tell us about that, Derek?
The Crane Group is a lobbying firm that's based in the D.C. area, but they have an arm in California. And today, that's where Gikovich's main work happens. She's had a number of clients in California, including Phillips 66, Halliburton, SoCalGas, Kaiser, Lyft, the Port of San Diego, the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce, and others. One thing just to note about what you said is that I think it's quite striking, and it sheds a lot of light on how this whole game works, that as soon as Brown was elected, or right into the lead up to when he was elected, is when Gikovich tries to capitalize on her close ties to Brown, which, of course, her corporate clients that she would come to lobby for would pay her a lot of money to so they could, you know, tap into that.
Well, and you also lay out that while he was the mayor of Oakland, Brown hired her as the city's federal lobbyist, and she earned a total of $780,000 over a six-year period. So, you know, they've been scratching each other's backs for a long, long time. And as Jerry Brown returned to the governorship just 8 years ago, that relationship was as fertile as ever for for both sides and for the corporate entities that Gikovich lobbies for.
Sure. Again, it's just really striking how she went from earning more than $750,000 as a federal lobbyist for the city of Oakland under Brown to almost immediately flipping to becoming a lobbyist for corporate clients to lobby Brown when he became governor. So going from her former employer to lobbying her former employer, in essence, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, Derek, one of the reasons that your investigative report had such an impact on me is that in the summer of 2017, Jerry Brown gathered the media at Treasure Island, that's opposite the San Francisco waterfront, for this great photo op. He trotted out former Governor Schwarzenegger, whose only accomplishment as governor, really, was the passage of AB 32, the cap-and-trade bill. And Jerry Brown, with this big media presence and a rhetorical flourish, was extending AB 32 for an additional period of time. And he was claiming that this is a huge success in the war against climate change. Now, I'm a person who doesn't think much of cap and trade. I'm not totally opposed to it, but I don't think, as it's currently laid out, that it does provide the incentives for the carbon emitters to reduce those emissions. And particularly the way the system has been set up to give free passes to the existing refineries and other smokestacks makes it really a joke. That aside, it was environmental scientist Greg Karas who analyzed on my podcast the elements of the two bills that Jerry Brown signed that day on Treasure Island. And one of those bills included preemptions of the work of the existing regional air quality districts, and in particular, the Bay Area Regional Air Quality Board was poised at that time to impose new regulations on the Chevron refinery, which is dominant in the small town of Richmond, just across the bay from me. And so those preemptions were gravely concerning. And there were also carve-outs related to diesel trucks and others. And it just left you saying, well, gosh, if this is what fighting climate change is supposed to be, I don't think we're ever going to fight it. And so the gap between the reality of what Brown signed and what the media accepted his claims of was as big as the Sacramento River.
I think that Jerry Brown is trying to have it both ways, and he can't. He can't simultaneously be a climate hero and have that as his legacy while he really refuses to take on, in a more aggressive way, the industry that more than anything else is causing our climate crisis, which is the oil industry.
And as you also cover in the report, one of the most egregious failures related to methane emissions occurred at the Aliso Canyon facility. And this started in October, and Jerry Brown didn't take any action until the middle or late January. And this emitted, it spewed, more methane than all the Priuses in California had scrubbed from the air in the preceding two or three years. And Brown just sat there, did nothing. The residential communities nearby had to be evacuated. And you show that when the legislature passed a bill to enhance the rights of those who had losses related to this environmental calamity, that ultimately, under the instruction of Lucy Gikovich, that Jerry Brown vetoed that legislation. Tell us more about that.
Right. So the California legislature passed, this was in 2016, in response to the Aliso Canyon disaster, which you just described. The legislature passed AB 2748, which would have given victims of the Aliso Canyon disaster more litigation options to sue SoCalGas. This would have included extending the statute of limitations from 2 years to 3 years for litigation. It would have forced the company to pay the defendants the plaintiff's legal fees. It would have allowed victims to sue again for damages that might have not been known at the time of a previous settlement. So in all kinds of ways, it would have given more options to victims of that horrible disaster to seek accountability from SoCalGas. So SoCalGas in 2016 subcontracted Lucy Gikovich to lobby the governor's office directly on that bill. In her lobbying filing, it says very specifically that she was lobbying the governor's office on AB 2748. And shortly after she was brought on as a lobbyist, Brown vetoed the bill. And in a subsequent quarter, she was paid $50,000.
Mm-hmm. And Derek, you know, what's fascinating about that, at the time, when we saw the inaction of Brown, and then we saw this bill vetoed in years following, we speculated that it was because his sister Kathleen, Kathleen Brown, was state treasurer. She ran for governor and lost to to Pete Wilson way back there in the 1990s. And she sits on a bunch of corporate boards, including Sempra Energy, which is the parent of SoCalGas. So right. Most people, this was all speculation, right? But the only connection we could come up with there was Kathleen's service on the board of Sempra. And so when we see Gikovich lobbying on behalf of SoCalGas and also a company called Mercury Public Affairs, which, you know, was a front or a pass-through for SoCalGas, This adds a new dimension. Now, let me play devil's advocate here. We cannot prove, right, that it was the work of Lucy Gikovich that caused Jerry Brown to veto that bill. But we can create the clear conflict of interest that suggests that that is the case.
Yeah, true. I think, you know, it's very difficult in any investigative research over lobbying to prove causality. Lobbying filings don't say that much. Usually, this stuff is very secretive. But what we tried to do in the report was show the pattern, how time and time again, as Gikovich was lobbying the governor's office for her corporate clients, how this closely correlated with actions by the governor that benefited her clients. And, you know, there had been some talk in the press about Gikovich's reputation as a lobbyist who could be hired to get Brown's ear. And so, for instance, that was talked about in 2015 when she was hired by the Downtown San Diego Partnership, as well as the San Diego Chamber of Commerce, to try to get Brown to veto Assembly Bill 504, which essentially what this would have done was create more public oversight over the decisions that a nonprofit that was controlled by business interests in downtown San Diego would make. This nonprofit that was controlled by business interests made decisions over land use in downtown San Diego. So Gikovich was brought in to lobby Brown to veto that bill. And it was just about a week after that it was announced that she was brought in that he did veto the bill against the wishes of what one would think was his progressive base in San Diego. And this was reported at the time. And if you go back and read the article about when it was reported, it makes it very clear that, you know, that it was understood that you hire her to get to Brown.
Mm-hmm.
So there's anecdotal evidence like that as well. Now, I should add that in response to our report, Gikovich and Brown, both sides claim that she never lobbied Brown directly. Brown even claimed that he didn't know that she was a lobbyist for Phillips 66.
Really?
That's the reporter who reported on this, Jessica Goodhart, tweeted out that's what Brown's office said.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'll leave it to people to read the report and make up their own minds, because it really boggles the mind to think that as she was lobbying Brown's office, for instance, on cap and trade, I believe 11 out of the last 23 quarters, as Brown was taking her and as a representative of the Crane Group on two foreign delegations in 2013, 2014 to China and Mexico, as he hired her former employee as his director of external affairs, as she was staying at his house multiple times, I think it really, takes a lot to not think that he knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And you know, there are other complications here. We know that Jerry Brown has been very careful about disclosing his personal wealth and the source of it. We know that his father, Governor Pat Brown, after he left office, was invited into some very lucrative oil and gas development deals in Southeast Asia. And so the Brown fortune, to the extent that he has one, and we actually don't know that much about his personal finances. He is retiring to a ranch that he inherited from his maternal grandfather up in Colusa County. But we, you know, Jerry Brown has never been forced to disclose, even as we hear people, you know, rail about Trump and his tax returns. And let's be fair, Bernie Sanders hasn't released his tax returns. And so, you know, there are unknowns, but things that, you know, we've had some sketchy information about for years about Brown that may have led to the bias that we see. And the other thing I have to say is that Jerry Brown is quirky and unpredictable. And there were many bills that he vetoed that came through the legislature with comments like not every problem can be addressed by a law. You know, he often would veto bills from friends of his in the legislature who thought that they had a clear indication that he would support it. So in some cases, he benefits from the way that he operated over the years, often not really being forced to explain actions that he took either for or against a specific piece of legislation.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that, you know, it's really hard to prove causality when it comes to these matters, just because of the scarcity of information that's in the public record. I mean, if you go and you look at lobbying filings, you know, the description of lobbying activity is extremely bare bones. But again, you know, I think the pattern over and over and over should at least, make one think, you know, really hard about this relationship. And, you know, it points to, you know, larger problems. I mean, first of all, Brown should have really been more careful with this. It's frankly a very inappropriate relationship to be so chummy with a lobbyist who has business before the governor's office, who's being extremely well compensated by corporate interests who are hiring her precisely, one would think, because of her very unique access to the governor and the governor's office. And we should add also that she only lobbied the executive office.
Right.
And so,
She didn't work the committees, the author of a bill, the party leaders in the legislature. She used one access point exclusively.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, Derek, you also, I want to at least briefly acknowledge that one of the other pieces of your report is a case from 2011 where Brown vetoed a bill to block the siting of a landfill in the San Diego area. And you are the first to report that Gikovich had lobbied against this bill. This was related to the so-called Gregory Canyon landfill. It's never been built, but this is a case where it does appear that her influence led Brown to make a decision. And he, in his veto message, you quote, "He lamented the unspeakable injustices the Native peoples have endured, acknowledged the profound importance of their spirituality and connection to the land, but he said he didn't think the legislature should overturn a hard-fought local land use decision." Well, that can be rationalized based on his experience in Oakland, because he did, and he's publicly acknowledged, that he learned a lot about the nuts and bolts of local government after kind of moving down the ladder to serve as the mayor of Oakland. At the same time, the influence of Lucy Gikovich can't be ruled out here.
Right. So it happened in the example that you're talking about back in 2011. ArcLight Capital, which is a private equity firm that's focused on oil and gas infrastructure, was invested in a landfill in Gregory Canyon near San Diego. And as you said, it never was built, and actually the project is dead in the water now. But at the time, there was a real controversy around it because it was going to be built right near the Pala sacred tribal ground of the Pala Indian tribe. And there was a lot of opposition to it by the tribe, by local environmental activists. And what ArcLight did is they brought in Gikovich. It was actually, you know, one of her first lobbying gigs in after she joined the Crane Group.
Mm-hmm.
After Brown became governor, sorry. She lobbied Brown's office, and shortly after that, Brown vetoed a bill which would have prevented the landfill from being built. So, again, as you say, there's no way to 100% prove causality, but you know, given the timing of it and given their relationship, it raises questions.
Well, and Derek, this is pure speculation on my part. I've known Jerry Brown since the 1980s. I've spent, you know, many hours talking with him. We're not friends, but we are acquainted and have mutual respect. But I can clearly see a scene where he's sitting there with Lucy Gikovich. And they talk in a way where they don't go into depth about who she works for and how much Phillip 66 paid her. He wouldn't ask and she wouldn't tell. But they would work with this kind of a code or, you know, the unspoken understanding of people who have been close for a long period of time and, you know, clearly know where the legal boundaries are of what you can openly do and know what you can get away with on a covert basis.
Yeah, you know, no one can know for sure, right? You know, I guess what we were just trying to do in the report was to, you know, document the public record and put the pieces of the puzzle together to show that how year after year Gikovich had been capitalizing on her access to the governor's office to earn what would probably amount to altogether millions of dollars to lobby for her clients. And, you know, we can speculate on, you know, what happened when Brown was staying at her house while she was also lobbying for these clients. But we can't really know. And again, you know, one of the reasons that the report calls for an investigation is because, it would be good to find out if this relationship affected, you know, the issues of real public concern. I mean, we're talking about, cap and trade and climate change, and the power of the oil industry and the mechanisms through which it influences or tries to get influence in politics in California.
Mm-hmm.
So, it would be great to find out more information.
And I will note that one thing you call for in the report is that the vetoes that Brown issued should be nullified or overturned. And frankly, I don't think there's a mechanism to do that. You cannot ring that bell.
It could be, but we wanted to raise the point that those vetoes might have been done under. Suspicious or unjust circumstances.
Indeed, they are tainted. And I think that, unfortunately, they will remain that way. So you referenced that one reporter tweeted some comments relayed from the governor's office. What other reaction did you get to the release of this investigative report in mid-December, Derek?
We've gotten a lot of positive feedback, just through our own communications. The media coverage was pretty slim.
Well, let me drill in on that. Did any major newspaper, the LA Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, or the Sacramento Bee, even reference that your report was published?
No, they didn't. And we reached out to them. I think it's important to keep in mind that it was the week before Christmas. It was, in the middle of Jerry Brown's sort of farewell tour.
Right.
And, it's possible that if the report came out 6 months earlier, the response would have been different. On the other hand, some of the mainstream media coverage of Brown has been, in my opinion, a bit uncritical at times. And
you're being way too generous.
it's also, you got to wonder if some of these outlets, I mean, this is something they really should have been on top of.
Yeah.
I mean, Jerry Brown's extremely close friend, former staffer, informal advisor, is the top lobbyist for one of the big oil powerhouses in the state, and has been so for the last 6 years. This is really something that should have been, I think, in the public record long before our report.
Indeed. And did you get any sharp criticism for the report other than from the parties covered?
No, we haven't. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback. It was criticized, as one would expect, by Jerry Brown's office, by his spokesperson. But the response we've gotten has been generally positive.
Well, Derek, I want to thank you and your partner, Kevin Connor, who investigated and published this piece. I will link to the full report in the show file for this podcast so our listeners can access it and read it at their leisure. And as we wrap up, I'd just like to ask you what else is in the pipeline at the Public Accountability Initiative.
Yeah, thanks. It's been great being on the show. We always have our hands in 100 different things. My main focus is researching the oil and gas industry. So I'm looking at a couple different things right now, which I don't want to give too much away. But if you check our website, and also we have a news site called Eyes on the Ties. You can see what we're doing. One thing we just posted today was a report on the restructuring of the debt in Puerto Rico. That's one mm-hmm. thing we've been really following, is the role of vulture hedge funds in profiting off of the crisis in Puerto Rico.
And let me ask you about this, because the first awareness I had of the Public Accountability Initiative is through Facebook ads for Little Sis. And whoever runs them, let them know they're effective. They got my attention, and I actually clicked through on a bunch of them. But what you do is you publish vignettes about the connections between powerful people and corporate initiatives, or, you know, I'm just raising an example, like the way Amazon hammered all the communities across the country for the second headquarters. I'm not saying that explicitly as one of the things you covered, but that's the kind of thing that I connect with Little Sis.
Right. So I should say that the Public Accountability Initiative is the sort of umbrella organization that I'm a part of. But Little Sis, and you can go to our Little Sis website at littlesis.org, that's a project of the Public Accountability Initiative. So it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Little Sis is an online database that we have of that contains information on the power elite, on powerful individuals and entities that have influence in our society. It's sort of an involuntary Facebook of the 1%, one might say. It's meant to be a research tool for journalists, for academics, for activists. We have, you know, I think at this point, 1.3 or 1.4, maybe a little off, million relationships on the database. But anybody can go and form an account and use it. We also have a visual mapping tool that people can use called the Olographer, to map out visual networks of power. Little Sis, by the way, is meant to be the opposite of Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people know us more by our popular name, Little Sis, but they're both the same thing, the Public Accountability Initiative and Little Sis.
Well, I'm looking at Little Sis right now, and it's a great companion with a lot of rich data for my friend Peter Phillips' new book, Giants. I don't know if you're aware of that, but Peter Phillips has been involved with Project Censored for many years, and he published a book in the fall about the interconnection of the people who run corporate boards, and it's a fascinating look at raw economic power. So I think these are two very worthwhile pieces of research that people can dig into. Well, Derek Seidman, thanks for spending time with us today and helping us understand your report, The California Oil Veto, and the work that Lucy Gikovich did while Jerry Brown was governor. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure on my part, too.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with investigator Derek Seidman. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.